Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jonathan Cortez, the producer and host of today's episode. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Monica Gossin about her book, The Racial Politics of Division, Interethnic Struggles for Legitimacy in Multicultural Miami, published by Cornell University Press in June 2019. Dr. Gossin is an associate professor of sociology at the College of William & Mary, where her teaching spans courses on Black communities in the United States, the experiences of immigrants in the U.S., and comparative race relations. Her research specializes in Africana and Latinx studies, international migration, interethnic relations, and race and gender in the media. In addition to the book that we will be discussing today, The Racial Politics of Division, Dr. Gossin has also published on race and gendered media representations of Asian and Black populations within the United States. Thank you so much for being with us today, Monica, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself, perhaps a bit about where you grew up, where you went to school, where you got your PhD, the field you got your PhD in, and how you became interested in the topic of interethnic relation amongst U.S. and foreign-born racialized peoples.
Sure. I grew up in Southern California. I usually just say Orange County since I moved around quite a bit throughout the county. One of the things that I, you know, from my experience in California that really brought me to this book was just kind of thinking about the multicultural context of the United States, how it's shifting, especially in places like Los Angeles and Miami, different cities where there's no majority population and the white population is smaller than the majority population combined. And so I was really interested in talking about some of those types of dynamics. You know, what are the racial dynamics in those spaces? Growing up in those spaces, I mostly had friends who were from different countries and, we all had a minority experience, but it was different based on where we were coming from. And I wanted to talk about, I really was interested in how those racial dynamics intersect. And so that's where I grew up. And that kind of brought me to some of these issues that I'm interested in and that I discussed in the book. And I ended up getting my PhD at UC San Diego in the Department of Ethnic Studies. And I was mentored by some wonderful people, Dr. Jane Rhodes, Raul Fernandez, Sarah Johnson, Dan Hallen, and Ana Celia Centella. And, I really benefited from their mentorship and as they helped me shape my project.
Nice. That's amazing. And specifically, now I'm really interested in how you came about thinking about Cubans in Miami, growing up in Orange County.
Yes. Well, it's really interesting. It came about in a roundabout way. One of it was through my interest in music. So when I was getting my PhD in ethnic studies, I was very much interested in kind of these cultural productions that people of color put forth and the political aspects of those cultural productions. And in thinking about that, I was interested in, you know, how people who are situated between these ideas of Blackness and Latinoness, how people who are situated in that space, how they navigate the United States, in particular, when we think about the realm of music, you know, Afro-Cuban music is definitely one of the things I was interested in. Celia Cruz, I've written a little bit about her and her positionality and reading her as a political figure and not just as a cultural figure. So I wanted to kind of expand, you know, when thinking about Afro-Latinos in general and Afro-Cubans in particular, I wanted to expand to beyond the cultural realm, but thinking about the political realm. And so I decided with that to kind of explore further, you know, the positionality of Afro-Cubans. And there's a lot of ways that that's similar to other people who are Afro-Latino, but very particular because of the ways that Cuban Americans have been situated in our society in terms of their political perspectives. And I wanted to kind of tease out the distinctions that Blackness makes for Cubans who come to the United States. How does Blackness kind of impact their experiences differentially than those who are white Cubans or who are mestizo Cubans? So I wanted to really kind of delve into that. And it kind of seems roundabout, given that I grew up in Orange County, but I thought that that kind of positionality of being both Black and Latinx was something I really wanted to explore.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I think that that is a great introduction into the book, right? The Racial Politics of Division, Interethnic Struggles for Legitimacy in a Multicultural Miami. So can you set the scene for us, right? What where are we? What are the different populations we're speaking about? What is important for us as readers to know in your introduction, right? What frameworks are you working with and what will help us better understand the rest of the book?
Sure. So there's a lot of complexity to Miami that is quite different from a space like Los Angeles or, you know, California in the fact that it has this history of being, you know, being a southern town where there is these distinct divisions between Black and white. And then people who would come in from other countries, they would be situated within that Black-white divide in particular ways. And I really wanted to explore, you know, how we see this transition from the Black-white divide to this divide that's much more multi-ethnic and how those shifts and how they intersect, actually, you know, this Black-white divide and this and the more multicultural divisions that happened when Cubans came in and other immigrant groups came in. So the populations that I'm interested in, generally, when people talk about this, they will talk about Blacks, whites, and Cubans, but they won't differentiate between Cubans. And so I really wanted to capture the distinctions, you know. So in the 1980s, it was really this key turning point for Miami and for the nation, really. In 1980, it was the beginning of the period called the Browning of the Browning of America. We had much larger populations of Latinx people coming into the United States. And so there's this shift, a larger shift in the culture of the United States from thinking about the U.S. as simply race relations being about Black and white, you know, in this post-civil rights movement, civil rights movement time period, to more this multicultural idea of what the United States was, because we had, you know, more immigrants coming from Asia and from Latin America. So at the time that we have this larger shift going on in the culture, we also have in Miami that the Mariel exodus would happen that year and would bring a much larger proportion of Black Cubans to the area than ever before. So those Black Cubans would change the way that we understand what it means to be Cuban. And it would also challenge African-Americans to think about this idea of Blackness and how they define that. And so because of all these complicated shifts that were going on at this time period, I really wanted to situate my study at this particular time and grapple with how these different populations were understanding these shifts. And one of the reasons why this was so important is because there had already been this kind of established division between African-Americans and Cubans, because African-Americans had just, you know, kind of won their fight against civil rights, but there were still lingering problems in Miami, police brutality, things like that, that African-Americans were still facing. And when Cubans were coming in such large numbers, African-Americans began to look at Cubans as part of the blame for some of the problems that were going on. And so this strict division was being set up between African-Americans and Cubans. And so one of the frameworks that I really wanted to bring in into the larger book is to understand divisions between racialized groups, not in an isolated sense, but always take into account what is it about our society? How does white supremacy play a role? You know, we don't want to leave, you know, to frame these as that in a sense that black, that whites are innocent bystanders on the side, and that this is simply this division between African-Americans and a newcomer from outside. I wanted to really analyze what was going on and understand the role of state intervention, politics, and those types of things in framing and shaping the way these divisions played out.
Yeah, I think for me, that was one of the more really interesting and like, because you sort of use different binaries through which to facilitate these relationships, right? The mm-hmm. the black-white binary, the native-foreign binary, worthy, unworthy, right? Can you talk maybe more about those and specifically how those binaries are facilitated through white supremacy, right? Mm-hmm. They're facilitated by and through white folks and white structures and infrastructures that are in place.
Right. Yes. So one of the things I really want to highlight in the book is the way that these really complicated racial dynamics get oversimplified within the white racial structure that we have. And one of the key dynamics that we have had in our society is this division that whites, white elites have put in place between and black and white, where white is worthy to be a citizen and black is unworthy or non-citizen. And we can see that in the way that laws were the way that people defined who can be a citizen, where blacks were left out of that, even if they were born in the United States. And so we see this kind of this racial division, black versus white, but we also see this division in terms of the idea of who is a native and who is a foreigner. And here is where we can see other groups sometimes adopting these racialized binary ideas. So for example, in the context of the book, when African-Americans were upset that the larger white structure was ignoring their concerns, some of the rhetoric that I found in my research was very much to highlight the fact that African-Americans were native to the United States. And so their needs and their concerns should be seen as more important than people who are foreigners. And so it's kind of this reinscription of the black-white binary or these binaries that the larger white society has put in place. And the other place that we can see these binaries is when immigrant groups themselves sometimes built this idea of who can be a good immigrant and who can be a bad immigrant. So that good immigrants are those who subscribe to all the ideals of the U.S. nation, such as freedom, being freedom-loving, hardworking, patriotic, and bad immigrants are those who come here looking for handouts or who are not self-sufficient. And so one of the points I wanted to make is about how these kind of racial notions about worthiness come to be taken for granted and to have come to be seen as a logical way to understand, racialized groups.
Yeah. And can you talk more specifically? I'm looking more into your first chapter, right? How you look at these different frames in Miami specifically, and maybe some of the history, thinking about the Cuban Revolution, thinking about the racialization of immigrants during the Cuban Revolution, and then also what that does with sort of restructuring Miami in a way, right, that complicates relationships not only between white populations, like non-Latinx white populations and African-Americans, but also white Cubans.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really complicated about the Miami situation as compared to other cities. So that in the United States or in Miami, we have already had these black-white divisions so that when black immigrants would come in from the Caribbean, they would be situated in particular ways where their ethnic background was less important than their racial background. So in terms of where they had to live and things like that, they would be segregated along those racial binaries between black and white. But when Cubans came in after Fidel Castro came in, it was more likely to be the white Cubans. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that this is related to the racial dynamics of Miami. Of Cuba, where whites were already, they had a similar system as the United States, where they have slavery and whites were most likely to benefit from that system and to be the wealthiest of that of the country. So then when Fidel Castro came in and tried to equalize the, the economy and all the shifts that were happening, white Cubans were most likely to be disenfranchised and to be those who would want to come to the United States when the U.S. opened up the way for them to come. And so it's this interesting divide that occurred partially because of the dynamics in Cuba that were already placed whites on top. Then also the U.S. with this rhetoric of anti-communism that allowed people who were coming from communist countries to be seen as more worthy of entry into the United States than people from other countries. And the groups that came in from Cuba at that time, they embraced that narrative. And so there's a particular political perspective that the Miami Cuban community is known for that supports kind of these ideas of this worthy versus unworthy immigrant narrative. And so all of those things kind of work together to complicate the relations that were there between African-Americans and Cuban-Americans in Miami.
Right. And I think that was also really important for you to do, right, is say that not only are we thinking about racialization processes in the United States, but Cuba has their own history,
right,
of racialization. And then by the later 20th century, we had seen this emergence of like a Cuban nationalism, right,
where
their thought process was or the racialization process was much more along the lines of if you're Cuban, you're Cuban, right, regardless of your skin color.
Right.
But then, right, heading towards chapter two, we see the Maria Exodus in 1980, right? And what then does the introduction of Marialito immigrants shift? How does that shift your understandings of race and immigration in Miami specifically?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the major things that we could see was, one, that we see a larger proportion of Black Cubans coming to the United States. So it disrupted this idea that Cubans are white and that they're only white. And this is the way that they were seen by African-Americans, but also among some Cubans themselves, where they kind of made this claim to whiteness. And so we see this as one of the main issues. But then another thing that was really important about the Mariel Exodus was that it also demonstrated the way that the U.S., the contradictions in the way that the U.S. handled immigration in general, but also how they handled the Cuban immigrants. So, the Marialitos were not welcomed in the same way that the earlier arrivals had been. They had much harder time finding sponsors. the U.S. is beginning to rethink their open door policy towards Cubans. And, you know, this is quite interesting, given the fact that the Marielitos, as they were called, were more likely to be Black, were more likely to be single men, were more likely to be poor. And, you know, and there is this idea of queerness, and all these different ideas of what was unwanted or what unworthy came along with the Mariel immigrants. And so we see this major shift that really helped to point out some of the contradictions in not only understanding race as kind of this distinct white versus Black or what have you, but also in the contradictions in terms of how the U.S. was treating all immigrants, but also Cubans in general.
Mm-hmm. And then so you're sort of, for at least this chapter, your main source of information, right, is El Miami Herald, right, which is a correct me if I'm wrong, like a Cuban owned newspaper or a predominantly Spanish speaking newspaper. So I'm curious then what was the reporting on the Mariel exodus in these papers and its relationship between Cubans who had arrived in Miami in maybe the 1950s and 60s versus the sort of new arrival of immigrants.
So what we see at this time period, I did look at some of the periodiquitos, or like the smaller Cuban-owned papers, but also the Miami Herald, El Nuevo Herald. And what we can see is a lot of different voices coming through in the paper that I examined. So we see that the Miami Herald, which was the more mainstream paper, was very anti-immigrant or very much against the Mariel entrants coming in, and painted them in this negative light, really kind of adopted the discourse that Fidel Castro was putting forth about how they are unworthy or how they're criminals. That was like the main way that Mariel immigrants were described in the newspapers. And one thing that really captured that was that just the abundance of reporting on crimes committed by people from Mariel. And so that's one of the, that was one of the major themes that came out of kind of associating Mariel immigrants with criminality. But we also saw at that time that was very clear in terms of Cuban American voices, is that there was a lot of ambivalence. Cubans wanted to embrace their newcomers. They wanted to defend them. You know, when people were saying these negative things about them, you know, they wanted to talk about why they were not unworthy. And so one of the points that I really bring out is how this was kind of illustrated through this language of dissociation. So this way of talking about how they really were worthy because they were patriotic, they were not asking for handouts, kind of adopting this language about worthiness to kind of bolster this image of the newcomers, to kind of rescue them from these narratives that were circulating in the larger culture. And one of the things I wanted to really highlight is how Blackness was, this kind of, I guess you would say, a code for, the bad immigrants. The bad Marielitos were those who were Black. And this wasn't overt in terms of saying, yes, all of those who actually have Black skin color are the bad ones, but more this idea of those who were committing crimes or who were not adopting the proper ideals, those are the bad ones, but the majority of them are actually good. So again, these binaries become these important ways to differentiate worthy versus worthy, non-worthy citizens.
Yeah, and then towards the end of chapter two, you have this sort of expose on the Casanova family.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about them?
Sure. So the Casanova family, there was a man named Juan Casanova, his wife and their son. And one thing that was really interesting is that the newspaper did a big expose on them. They so happened to be Afro-Cuban, but what the newspaper was trying to do was to capture the daily life of a Mariel family and how they were adapting to the United States. So one of the things that really came through in that expose was the way it was painting them as becoming American. So for example, one of the things that it said is that the little boy started to like Coca-Cola, and they got some appliances, they got a washing machine and these different types of things that showed that they were buying into kind of the capitalistic ideal of the United States, and that they weren't asking for handouts and these types of things. And while the reporting did capture some of the problems that they were encountering, really becoming a part of our society, it really kept this, more positive, optimistic view of how the Casanova family was faring without really addressing anything in relation to race that would be something important to take into account. And so I kind of, in that chapter, I analyzed some of the aspects related to race that might have impacted the reasons why, even though they were not actually, they were very educated, they had a lot of the, a lot of the qualities that you would think would make their story more similar to white Cubans in the United States. I wanted to point out some of the reasons or some of the issues that they were encountering that may be related to race and that the papers were ignoring.
Mm-hmm. So as of now, right, we have this story that we're trying to think about not only the immigration of Cuban immigrants post or during the Cuban Revolution, but also sort of 1980 with the Mariel exodus, and also the racialization between that that's happening in the U.S. and Cuba. And then chapter 3, you turn to the Black press, or more specifically, right, the African-American press.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of introduce us with a whole other perspective on Cuban immigration into Miami in the later 20th century. And so then can you talk more about how post-civil rights era African-American press, right, is grappling with the conceptualizations of Blackness and their own political positions of race in sort of a multicultural city like Miami?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was very important to talk about the African-American point of view because a lot of the scholarship that focuses on Cuban-Americans, first of all, neglects to capture the Black Cuban experience, but also to talk about their experiences in relation to other groups around them, including African-Americans. And for African-Americans during this time period, they had, they had been the largest minority group until Cubans came and surpassed them. And they were still dealing with some of the problems related to anti-Black racism. In 1980, for example, we had the McDuffie uprising, which was mm-hmm. their response to the killing of Arthur McDuffie just the year before. And it just so happened that same year, the Mariel exodus also occurred. So they were afraid that there was going to be this shift where the elite in the area would shift their focus onto immigration, onto the Cuban presence, and away from their lingering concerns. And so in the newspaper, we see that they were grappling with this idea of how to, whether they could understand Cubans as minorities like themselves or as kind of like these new white oppressors. And a lot of the way that they were discussed in this newspaper, this was the Miami Times, was as white immigrants. And one of the reasons why that distinction was being made is because Haitians were also coming in at the same time period, Haitians who were more readily identified as Black. And Haitians were not receiving the same treatment as Cubans. They were not allowed to enter the United States, they were being sent to Guantanamo. They were not seen as worthy of rescue. And so African Americans, seeing this, you know, this disparity in treatment of these two immigrant groups, really interpreted this as kind of the white elite, you know, reinscribing the kind of white-black binary that they've been experiencing for, you know, for years in the local sense, you know, in terms of the way that immigration policy was being formed and thought out. And, but with the Mariel Cubans, it really challenged African Americans to kind of rethink this as simply about race, as simply being about race or whiteness or blackness, because Cubans, you know, they were able to observe were not only white, but also black, and that there are also contradictions in how the Mariel Cubans were being treated by the U.S. in terms of immigration policy. So there was a lot that African Americans were grappling with in terms of how to frame their own fight against the continued disenfranchisement they were experiencing, and how to incorporate immigrants into the conversation about race and what's going on in our society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so on page 94, you say specifically just that, right? You say the Times, I'm reading from the book now, you say the Times coverage suggests that African-American evaluations of the Mariel exodus were not simply about competing for scarce resources, but were shaped by their attempts at a deeper ideological critique of U.S. immigration policy and the ways it upholds white dominance.
Right.
So I think it was really exciting to see that analysis, that like it wasn't that they were feeling bad for their loss of jobs, but there was a sustained and intentional critique of how Haitian immigrants are being treated differently than Cuban immigrants. And specifically along the lines of race.
Right.
And I think, yeah, I just found that incredibly refreshing and also so complicated, right? Because then what does the African-American press do with the presence or absence of Afro-Cubans in the larger understanding of Cuban immigration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that I wanted to point to in that chapter and in the book as a whole, is, you know, the complexity of all these different things, the way that race is a part of these dynamics, even when it may not seem to be the case, and the different ways that this kind of plays out, you know. So I think like this idea that certain immigrants, those fleeing communist countries, are more worthy than those fleeing other countries, was something that I think the Black press, you know, that's something that was necessary, like a nuance for them to understand the dynamics that were going on, so that, you know, kind of the way that the U.S. Goes about its immigration policy goes hand in hand with the way that it goes about its civil rights policy that impacts African Americans. And so one cannot, you know, really play one against the other, African Americans versus immigrants, but really we have to see how these issues are intertwined and remember how the role of white dominance in all of this, and how is this supporting an order, a racial order that keeps whites in power?
Right. Because thinking about like these things happen at different scales, right? Yeah. You have sort of Miami or maybe even neighborhood, right? But then immigration policy gets set at the state and national level, mm-hmm. right? So how are those filtering down and up? How are processes of racialization moving both ways?
Right.
Now I want to sort of try to move into chapter 4, right? Framing the Balsero crisis, the racial and moral politics of suffering. Can you tell us about what's happening in the later part of the 20th century, specifically 1994? Where are we? Where is Miami? And how, mm-hmm. what is the racial landscape look like when the Balsero crisis starts to occur?
Okay, sure. Yeah. So this time period is quite distinct from the 1980s. The 1980s, we really had this Cold War rhetoric that was framing all the dynamics that we see going on, you know, that we were just discussing. But by the 1990s, you know, the Cold War was waning. And we have this discourse that had grown, you know, regarding human rights and where the U.S. or the U.S. and the world was actually, you know, promoting this idea that one should care about the rights of people, you know, immigrants, refugees, those types of things. We saw at this time period, the changes that were going on in South Africa and how the U.S. was involved in sanctioning South Africa to bring about the shifts in that country and how worldwide pressure made for those changes. So this idea, this idealization of human rights became this narrative or this type of terminology that could be called upon by oppressed groups to advocate for themselves. So we saw this in the case of Cuban Americans and also for African Americans who were looking to what was going on in South Africa to call on the U.S. to fully bring about, you know, the end of the oppression of Blacks in the United States. So we have this shift in terms of that. And so then when the Balseros came, it was very much part of this whole shift from the Cold War, because the fall of the Soviet Union created these conditions in Cuba where there was this scarcity and where they had to ration medicine and food. And this created conditions where more Cubans wanted to leave. And they were, you know, coming on balsas with these little boats, or these little rafts across the United States, you know, really in this state of desperation. And one of the ways that this was viewed by people in the U.S., there was definitely a lot of sympathy for them coming in. But at the same time, they were beginning to be seen more as economic refugees rather than political refugees. So there, we have, again, this shift in understanding about Cubans and who they are and how, whether we should accept them in the United States, whether we should keep the open door or not. In Miami, locally, African Americans were still fighting the same battles they had been before. Their, you know, economic situation had not improved. And so when this new group of Cubans were coming in, there was the same tensions that were there in the 80s between Cubans and African Americans. And so it's a really, you know, complex issue that has a lot of similarities to what they were experiencing in the 1980s, but also has these other dynamics that would impact Cubans differently, in that they were able to see that the U.S. was really starting to turn kind of a blind eye towards their needs. And I think there's a lot of contradictions that were being revealed in this particular time period.
Right. And I think even an even further realization that those contradictions post-civil rights movement had been happening for, at this point, almost 20 years.
Right.
I want to talk about specifically African-Americans' understanding of Pan-Africanism at this time in relation not only to Haitian immigrants, right, but mm-hmm. you sort of offer a glimmer of understanding with the writings of Rosa Reed.
Yes.
In the African-American press. Can you talk about that possibility? Can you talk about what Rosa was doing, what she was writing, and how she was navigating the world as an Afro-Cuban in the Black press?
Mm-hmm. That was really an interesting aspect of this time period, is how the Black press had incorporated this prominent Afro-Cuban female voice. She had her own column, and she gave commentary that positioned her, that showed her complicated positionality. And again, one of the reasons why I really wanted to focus in on, you know, the Afro-Cubans who were coming at these time periods, because it really helps to complicate all these particular ideas about what race is, you know, these static ideas about race. Mm-hmm. And so she was speaking from the perspective of someone who acknowledged her Blackness, was very much aligning herself with African Americans because of, you know, being Black. But she also had some ways that she was aligning herself with Cubans. She had a lot of critique, though, of how Cubans were understanding what was going on at the time, you know, in terms of what U.S. policy should be towards towards Cuba. And she was very much clear in calling out some of the ways that white Cubans were mistreating Black Cubans. Mm-hmm. So she really had this voice that, you know, served to complicate the idea of what it means to be Cuban, what it means to be Black. And I think that was really, it was really a welcome aspect of, you know, what the paper was doing. One thing I would note, too, is that, you know, the paper, even though there was a lot of negative coverage of, you know, negative framing of Cubans, and, you know, this kind of opposition was being set up between Black and white Cubans, we also had other voices, especially from Black politicians who had syndicated columns that ran in a paper which warned against kind of the divide and conquer politics that was coming out. So we had, you know, these multiple voices coming out in the newspaper.
Yeah, for me, one of the things that I found, at least in chapter four, most striking, even though as sort of people who understand race and race making, we know this, right? But you write it on page 124, you say, African-American concerns, as they also took on the cause of Black Haitians, revealed the truth about the U.S. racial framework. That is, that Blacks, whether foreign-born or native-born African-Americans, could not escape their constructions as other in some shape or form when compared to whiteness or Americanness. Mm-hmm. Right? That regardless of these frameworks that we're trying to work in or fit in, that were set by white supremacist structures, Blackness always fails. Mm-hmm. And then how did that play out on the sort of landscape of media, newspaper media in the later 20th century in Miami? I think your book does that amazingly.
Thank you.
And my favorite chapter was chapter 5, I think, because this is where really the voices of Afro-Cubans and the interviews you conducted with Afro-Cubans really shined through and allowed us to really get to an understanding of how you're thinking about Afro-Latinidad within all of these frameworks, right? And I really want to talk about chapter 5 and your thought process behind Afro-Cuban encounters at the intersections of Blackness and Latinidad.
Great. Yeah, I think one of the things I really wanted to do with that chapter is I wanted to allow us to delve deeper into how Afro-Cubans themselves were thinking about some of the dynamics that we've been talking about in the previous chapters that were going on. I wanted to hear their voices and them talking about their experiences, their personal experiences. And So some of the things that was very clear is how they saw themselves as kind of in this in-between space, how they were even if they didn't see themselves there, they were placed there by other people. So people would encounter them and wouldn't know what to do with them. You know, so, you know, are they African-American? Are they Latinx? You know, how do you even define what they are? One of the big things that they talked about is that in Miami, they would often be misrecognized or not recognized as Cuban. Even when they spoke, they would think maybe someone would see that they have an accent from Cuba, but many white Cubans would not recognize that they were Cuban. And they saw this as this kind of slight, as this denial of Blackness by some white Cubans in Miami. And so there is this issue for them, not only as being an immigrant of having to deal with, you know, how to become American, how to, you know, be seen in the United States and deal with that transition, but also what does it mean to be Cuban in the United States? Because there had been such a divide between, you know, what it means to be Cuban, whether it's you have to adopt a certain type of politics, a political perspective, it means that you are a certain color and not another color. So there is also a grappling with that, along with just the dynamics that are there of trying to adjust to a new environment. So there is those issues they ran into with other Cubans, but also not fitting completely within, you know, African-American circles, because either the language barrier or African-Americans having a limited idea about what it means to be Black, where someone who's not an English speaker may not be viewed as a true Black, quote unquote. So this kind of in-between positionality, I talk about how it allowed for a particular perspective by which they could analyze race that I felt that we could learn a lot from.
Yeah, I think I like this chapter so much because, like, this is what I would teach. Like, this is the chapter that I'd be like, let's go to this because this is what we as Latino studies need to be looking at, right? Mm-hmm. And specifically, I was really excited about page 160, where you talk about, you say, Afro-Cubans have a multiple positionality that allows them to disrupt and cross the United States' rigidly policed ethnic racial boundaries. But then in the same paragraph, you go on to say, like, I don't mean mestizaje. I don't mean color blindness, right? Again, bringing together both Latin American and U.S.-based notions of racial processes, right? But you say, instead, I contend the resistive potential of in-between identities lies in the fact that they further illuminate the strength of hegemonic power dynamics that dictate the idea that one's placement in particular categories makes them more or less worthy of social membership and national belonging. And I can go on, but I want to hear you talk about in-betweenness and Afro-Latinidad in the United States and the potentiality of disruption.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important to think about Afro-Latinidad that complicates this idea of mestizaje. I think that you know, a lot of scholars who talk about Afro-Latinidad, one of the contributions I think that's made there is disrupting this idea that mestizaje is the thing that's going to save us, right? So this idea that we're in between, that we're a mixture of all these different ethnic and racial groups, that in and of itself is what disrupts, you know, the binaries, and that challenges, you know, these racial distinctions that are being made in our society. Because one of the things that Afro-Latinx folks encounter is also in this racism that other Latinx folks are, you know, projecting their way. So we have white, you know, Latinx folks and mestizo Latinx folks telling them that they are not true Latinos, that they don't belong, that something about their Blackness makes them inferior. And so I think that it's important to bring in how Blackness complicates this idea of mestizaje as the thing that will save us. And the other thing that I thought that was really important about that is that it helps us, you know, when we hear these stories from people who are Afro-Latinx, in particular these the interviewees in this chapter, is that we see that they complicate this idea of race from all different sides. So people who are who think Pan-Africanism is going to save us, you know, they're complicating those ideals. You know, people who, so, you know, I think there's a lot of ways that they're complicating these binaries and these issues, but it's not simply about being in between. That's the thing that, you know, that is the thing that is resistive. It's not simply just being in between, but it's just the fact that the experience that they have being viewed as other, it illuminates the problem. It illuminates how strong this problem continues to exist, and that it isn't something that is overcome simply because you are in the middle. And so that's something I really wanted to bring out in their stories.
Yeah, thank you. And one more thing, just on page, this is back to, again, this idea of Afro-Latinx and Latinidad and Latinx studies. You say on page 191, an uncritical celebration of Latinidad, there is much that is obscured. As scholars of Afro-Latino studies have argued, it is essential for scholarship to engage with how racist notions of Latin America and the United States intersect and differentially affect the immigration incorporation of Afro-Latino immigrants into the specific national context of the United States. And then you say, examining how Afro-Cuban immigrants negotiate the intersections of Blackness and Latinidad and rejections they sometimes face from other Latinos allows an important critique of the ways white supremacist notions have been embraced or perpetuated by non-Black Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
Highlight, underline, starred, everything.
Yeah, I think those intersections are, you know, another aspect of the complexity that I really wanted to delve into with this book. You know, so not only is it about what happens when people cross borders into the United States and how they experience the racial climate that's already existing, but how the racial perspectives from their country of origin or from other people's country of origin, how those perspectives which are brought here intersect with the U.S. So, you know, for example, like with some Cuban Americans, the ideals in Cuba that kept white, you know, on the top and Black on the bottom, they come and intersect with the way the U.S. also frames race in a similar fashion, but differently. So there's different ways these will intersect and they will impact people. And I really wanted to capture that. I think those complexities are something that we have to grapple with, because they really structure how Afro-Latinx immigrants experience life in the United States.
Yeah, thank you. And before I ask you sort of the more common question on new books, I want to ask about your conclusion. Where are we now? You sort of open up the conclusion with thinking about police brutality or anti-Black racism, and move on to think about where Miami is today. Do you have anything to add about the conclusion or where your hopes are for the book?
Yeah, I think that in terms of the hopes for the book, it's situated within Miami, because I think Miami allows us to have this really fascinating place to explore these issues related to race and how they can be so complex and complicated by Black-white binaries and also immigrant-foreigner binaries, good versus bad. All of these kind of dynamics, they really show up in profound ways in this particular space. And I think that there's so much to be learned from Miami. And it's shifting so much today where, you know, for example, a place like Calle Ocho, you know, it's not, it used to be a very Cuban space and isn't anymore. So there's a lot of shifts already going on in Miami that we need to continue to look at. So I think there's a lot that we learned about Miami in particular, but I think that this goes beyond Miami, because I think I wanted us to talk about these dynamics and how these ideals about worthiness and unworthiness come to be seen as they've come to be logical, so that even people of color might subscribe to some of these ideals. How does this come to be? And I wanted to think about how this might play out in other cities as well. One of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, it's definitely in conversation with work that is about African-American and Latinx relations. It's in conversation with that work. And that work points to the fact that, you know, divisions between these groups is not the norm. It's not the primary way that race relations play out. But it's also important to examine deeply when those divisions do occur, how do we understand them? How do we break them down so that we can kind of revise our thinking and continue to focus on the larger dynamics that divide us and kind of put forth this divide and conquer perspective. You know, I really wanted to kind of bring out how the book can go beyond the Miami context to think about the larger United States. And so those are some of the things that I the conclusion gets into, thinking about how immigration policy at this current moment, some of the contradictions that are showing up, and how those really go along with what we see going on with, you know, the killing of Black men, that we just, you know, there's always every month or every year, there's a new issue in relation to that. And so I want to continue to keep the conversation going about how this is playing out in the present.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And I think for folks who haven't gotten a chance to read the book, there is a really fascinating section in the last chapter about Afro-Cubans in Los Angeles, which is fun to read, right? Going from Miami, the entire book, to Los Angeles. But thank you, Monica, so much for your time. One more question, sort of a question we ask every interviewee on New Books is, what are you working on now?
Well, now I really want to, there's a few different projects that I'm interested in, but some of them that are related to this book have to do with the changes, the shifts in U.S. policy towards Cuban immigrants. In particular, I'm interested in Cubans who are trying to come through the U.S.-Mexico border and the way that they are being treated, similar to all other immigrants, because of the way the asylum laws have been shifting under the new administration. I want to really delve into some of those contradictions, and in particular, how Black Cubans may be faring, you know, as they're caught up within these shifts. So that's one thing that I'm really interested in exploring and I've been working on. Another one that I'm interested in is for further exploring political divisions within groups. So within African-American groups, within Latinx groups, political divisions, you know, that frames, I think one of the things that people they have this idea that, you know, minority groups are united politically and that there's one particular way that they think. And I think that even if you say, for example, Latinx groups are more likely to be Democrats, there's these divisions that we're seeing popping up, you know, these smaller groups who might be conservative or what have you. I really want to explore some of these divisions and how they relate to some of the themes that I talk about in my book.
Those both sound incredibly fascinating, and I'm sure we're all waiting. We'll all be waiting for them. But
thank you.
Monica, thank you so much for your time and for being with us today on New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks.